of the rooms. Are we unmuted? Okay. To please sign in. All right, so there's any, we'll start with public comment on the Carson campus, if there's any public comment. Okay, if there's any public comment in the Fallon campus. Fallon, are you out there?
We are out there.
Oh, there we go. Hi, guys. Okay. Just to remind you that there will be additional public comment availability at the end of this session. So we have Dr. Lisa Rhine with us as one of our presidential candidates. So I'll let you go ahead and start. You can give some input on your background and then as they have questions.
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you for being here today. I know there's a number of other things you could be doing right now, but I am very pleased to be able to meet you and to meet other people that work here and people from the community. I'll tell you a little bit about me. My personal story is much like any of our community college students, potentially. I was a first-generation college student. I was one of six kids raised by a father who had English as a second language. And it was college and education that broke the cycle of undereducation and poverty in my family. And the reason I do this work is to help others, as many as possible, to actually leverage education in the same way so that they can improve their social mobility. So that's my heart. That's why I do what I do. I have 30 years of professional experience, 28 in higher education. First job out of college, I worked as a children and youth case manager, a social worker in a community mental health system in Dayton, Ohio. And then I worked as a hospital social worker in a psychiatric hospital. And I held the treatment planning conferences with the psychiatrist and did the discharge planning. And then I had my first job in higher education in 1989 at Sinclair Community College, large public institution, urban in Dayton, Ohio. I started as a learning disability specialist in the Office of Counseling, and then in 1990, with the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, I was fortunate to build the first disability support program on that campus, and actually worked with the Ohio Board of Regents and select colleges around the state, and we created all of the first policies and procedures for disability services in the state. And it was an awesome opportunity because I was in my early 20s at the time. So to be able to be involved at the state level was really cool. I was there for 11 years. I left, I had responsibility when I left for tutoring, English as a second language programming, testing, supplemental instruction, and a mental health grant supported program. And I was recruited to the University of Dayton. And they asked me to build their disability support program there. And it was a private university, so different regulations and requirements, but it's a great opportunity to do something that you've done once again and learn from mistakes, right? And when I left University of Dayton, I had responsibility for tutoring, for a summer bridge program, for first year experience, and for developmental education. I then went to Wittenberg University, and it's a small liberal arts college in Springfield, Ohio, and I went as the associate provost for student success and retention, and small place, so I got to learn the full breadth of what it is to run a campus. We had a provost and we had an associate provost, right? And so I had responsibility for all things outside of the classroom except for housing and student life, and then I also had many academic responsibilities in terms of determining students on academic progress, dismissal, suspension, also the gen ed requirements and gen ed assessment, and responsibilities for academic advising, which there was entirely done by the faculty. So left Wittenberg University for Northern Kentucky University, and I started out there as the assistant vice president for student affairs, and the vice president after 3 years, moved to another institution, and I served in the interim role for 2 years as the Vice President for Student Affairs. Come on in. So anyway, then that brought me to Tidewater. Right now I serve as a campus provost. It's kind of a misnomer because I have full responsibility for everything on the campus, including academic affairs, student affairs, facilities, budget, personnel, everything. And I also have responsibility for two of our regional centers. One is the Regional Automotive Center, and the other one is a Tri-City Center, which is a collaborative between Old Dominion University, which is our primary institution where we send students, and Tidewater. So on my three campuses, or my campus and my two centers, I serve 12,000 credit students annually, and we are part of a larger system within a college. So my college of Tidewater Community College has four comprehensive campuses, four provosts, and seven centers. And we serve 33,000 students in Hampton Roads for credit. So I'm one subset of that, but we also exist within the system, within one chancellor of the community colleges in Virginia, and there's 23 of those. So it's a very big system and a very big college, but I have my little slice of that. So that brings me to current day.
Okay, so any questions?
Dr. Ryan, thank you for your time today. Appreciate it. Jeff Brader with the College Foundation.
Yes.
Certainly appreciate you coming here for us. Tell us a little bit about the importance of partnerships with private industry as it relates to workforce development. As you probably know, one of that is growing pretty rapidly, and a lot of demand on workforce development that supports in the industry that's here. So maybe a little bit of
yes, absolutely. Can they hear the question on that end?
Yes.
Good, good. So I just had a conversation with the Vice Chancellor around that issue, and I strongly believe that the Nevada's community college are the key drivers of the economy if we're serious about closing the skills gap. I mean, we are the institution situated to do that. The universities are not going to do that. And that space is empty right now, but what we saw in Virginia is that there were a number of proprietary schools that started popping up around us, and they will step into that space if we don't claim it. And so we have an obligation, I think, and as a president of a college, to step into that space and intentionally, and I suggested by industry cluster, go in and find the demand, you know, the high demand, high wage jobs, and align with the data and needs of those to create programs to support them. And if we have to do it, the economy depends on it. The economy depends on it. So I think we have to go in and claim the space, and we have to figure out a way to meet the needs. And back to my original comments, it's not just about applying high demand jobs. It's about high demand jobs that offer a high wage, because this is about moving students in their social mobility. And so we've been having a conversation in Virginia. We have a number of programs that are high demand, but they don't pay well. They don't even pay a living wage, right? And so morally and ethically, I struggle with bringing people in and taking the money and putting them in debt and giving them a job that isn't going to move them beyond their means today. And so we have to be creative about doing that. So in the CNA program, for instance, we're now, and even automotive, we have four manufacturers in automotive, Chrysler, Honda, Toyota, and Ford, but they're only paying $9 an hour for entry-level employees. And the living wage in Virginia is $13 an hour for one person, $26 for an adult with one kid. So when we came to the table with the auto manufacturers, they were saying, you know, we have a skills gap, you know, we can't hire people. I said, we have a wage gap, right? So we have an obligation to really use the data to inform them as well. They were like, oh, you, right? So I think there's just a way we play a role in coordinating what's necessary to drive the economy. And we can do that by engaging people with data and systematically making sure we find the high demand, high wage industries to be able to set up what we do and be flexible and agile enough to respond to their needs, because they're going to change as rapidly as we create the curriculum. And I'm sure it's the same in Nevada as it is in Virginia. You know, we can sometimes be inflexible institutions. Sometimes to get through curriculum committees and things, it can take a long time, and then we're out of date and changing it again, right? So I think we just need to find ways to be more flexible and agile to meet the needs, but we've got to step in the space and plan it.
Thank you.
Rochelle Tisdale, Foundation, WNC Foundation. Western Nevada College has a lot of rural outreach. What experience do you have with that, and what can you bring to that to make a college education, a community college education, more accessible to all students in rural communities?
Yeah. So I was looking at the successes, and I think there's many here at Western Nevada. One being the Latino cohort, one being the JumpStart program. I think that there's a number of those that are doing really good work. However, when I looked closely at them, I can see that those are aimed at students that are college ready already. Okay. So how do you scale up good ideas and good programs to support students that may not be college ready? And I want to say this because it bothers me, that we need to stop asking who's college ready, and we need to say, are colleges student ready? Okay, so that's an important juxtaposition, right? So I want to say, what are we doing to make sure that all students are successful, not just some? Because I do believe that closing those achievement gaps is the answer to the enrollment problem, the retention problem, and the completion problem. And so if there's a way that we can get in and actually address all the underrepresented groups that are performing or report, just wherever the skills, the performance gaps exist, use the data to drive our action. And in terms of rural, so I'm in Hampton Roads, which is coastal Virginia, and there's four cities that each have a campus in my college. So it's Virginia Beach, Chesapeake, Portsmouth, and Norfolk. And I'm in Chesapeake, it is the most rural. And so I say that because we've had that challenge as well. And so we have had to go where the students are. So high school is one of them, but more importantly, to understand the varying cultures and where their communities are. And so we were struggling with the performance of African-American males, and that our data was telling us that. And so we worked to engage the churches, because their social life and a lot of the community was around the churches. And so we're now working with some pastors in the area, and we had some faculty and staff that were actually in those churches that were able to lead some of that. So I think you just have to find creative ways to reach those populations and then make sure that college is student ready, right?
Okay, some more questions?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Tanya Champa, Foundation Board. Thank you for your time. Just talking a little bit about a plan, if you will, what would you say, if you were selected for this opportunity, would be your top three objectives once you got on campus?
Okay, so when I researched this institution, the first thing I did is I read the governor's plan, and then I read the chancellor's plan. And the chancellor's plan had elements in it. There's five of them, but there were four that spoke to me, right? And so they were access, success, closing achievement gap, and workforce development. And the other one was research, but that's kind of the university deal, right? So I was fortunate to have gone through a highly selective process, selected as a presidential fellow for the Aspen Institute. There were 450 applicants, 40 individuals selected, and it was really a life-changing experience for me. It was a year of professional development, 4 weeks in residence over that year, working with Stanford faculty, and some dozens of the nation who have changed their institutions around in terms of success and completion, okay? And many of them were awarded Aspen Prizes for excellence in the community college for doing that work. And we spent a year talking about how are we gonna be able to create more credentials, produce more credentials of high quality to a more diverse population at a lower cost. So that was the question we focused on for a year. But we did it within these frames of access to learning, completion, equity, and labor market. And so when I was doing the research and I saw those elements of the Chancellor's plan matched perfectly, different terminology, but perfectly the same area. So those essentially are the areas of focus, and I feel like I'm uniquely prepared having gone through that experience. And the varied experience that I've had at colleges and universities across in the Midwest and Virginia, I've seen varieties of attempts to solve the same issues, right? Using different methodologies based on student body, and I just think I'm uniquely prepared in that way to address those things.
Okay, Buzz, I think you had a question. Might want to take it off mute.
Is it valid? You're so tiny.
You guys are you're still on mute. There you go. Now we can hear you.
All right. My question is.
Make sure
is
you're.
This.
Buzz, you need to introduce yourself, please.
Oh, yeah, in here. Okay. Buzz Sharman. Churchill County.
Thank you.
My question is this. You've already had a question about rural centers, so I'm not going to duplicate that in a multi-campus institution.
Yeah.
But my question is, are you willing to make the very hard changes that need to be made at this institution, at least in my view? And I'll give you an example. I'll give you two examples.
Okay.
Over the last number of years, I would say over the last decade, the emphasis at this institution has been to draw high school students to the institution, which is an honorable thing to do. But in doing so, the nighttime student has really been lost. Mm-hmm. At this campus, at this particular campus in Fallon, we've gone over the last 15 years where we've dropped from 1,400 headcount down to, I don't know what it is now, maybe 400. So that loss has been because this campus was driven by the adult working student who was looking to get an education to upgrade their employment. That enrollment is now lost to online. Okay, online education basically is it. The other example is just recently, I just looked at the schedule for the fall, and there's no welding class on the schedule for Fallon in the fall, and that might seem like a very silly thing to make a big deal of, but we've had welding classes in this agricultural community for over 40 years. The fall will be the first time there's no agriculture or no welding class, and those are high-paying jobs, as you probably well know.
Yes.
And so what I'm asking you, with those examples, are you willing to, yes, look at the data? Are you willing to look at the communities? Are you willing to make the tough decisions that it's going to take to increase enrollments, to bring the college back to a point where it's serving its communities?
Right, I think absolutely. I mean, if the data bears it out, the data tells us we need to make those changes, and it's around access, success, and completion, and building the labor market, then there's no question if that's our priority. Those are our hard conversations to have. I was just talking with the Vice Chancellor about that. So if you are focused on high demand, high wage jobs, then what do you do with the high demand, low wage jobs, right? Do we continue to do that, or do we find creative ways to make those successful as well? And so in the example of the CNA, right, I we talked about, can we cluster that and do some kind of interdisciplinary program where they also take classes in business, and we have a small business entrepreneurial track. You know, so you're setting up a CNA to go to do their own business, or an auto person to go do their own business, as opposed to just, you know, working for the man, right? So I think, yes, I think we wouldn't right out of the gate say we're going to get rid of programs. I think we would say, are there creative ways that we can support this high demand area with a living wage? And if there isn't, then the hard questions need to be asked, because we only have so much money and resources to go around. So if everything lines up with the plan and we stay focused on the priorities, then everything that we do should support those. So, and of course I was going to say yes, I mean, right?
Going to be critical, because you did a nice job of that question.
Thanks.
Sometimes following the data can be a cop-out, because when you eliminate programs, you eliminate data. And so my question is, are you willing to take risks?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question. I was telling the other group, they may, I don't know if you know this, but we had to take like a little personality assessment. And I'm a risk taker, calculated risk and informed risk, yes. I'm not interested in, like I said, coming in and turning over the apple cart, because I think by all measures right now, you're doing well. You know, your enrollment generally is up. You're meeting all your performance indicators, performance-based funding. I'm convinced that there is data there that's going to tell us some things about ways that we can take it to the next level, improve, and focus. So, yeah, I would say I take risks, informed risks.
Thank you.
Do we have more questions here in the Carson campus? Go ahead, Rochelle.
Rochelle Tisdale, Domancy Foundation. As the president of the college, how would you work with the foundation board to help develop the board and opportunities, give us inform, and maybe some new programs and whatnot, and communicate needs of the college?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how that's structured currently in terms of the board's relationship with the president, and if there is a regular communication plan around that, but I'd start with that. You know, how can we communicate on a regular basis? What does communication look like to you? What are your expectations? And how we can be transparent about our interaction. But in terms of helping the foundation, one of the things that I found incredibly helpful is to be able to find the pain point of the various industries in our area. You know, they have something or a problem they're trying to solve, and by creating relationships with them and figuring out how we can solve their problem, we often solve our own and get resources back to the institution in terms of gifts and equipment and other things, or even things like mentoring and working with our students, offering opportunities for job shadowing and internships. So I've just been really successful in that, and going in and developing relationships and, you know, how can we help you? I mean, if we focus that externally, it returns to us tenfold. And so that's the kind of work that I would do, and I would need the foundation's help to do that, obviously. And when I went into the Virginia's community, I didn't know anyone. I didn't know a single person that lived in Virginia. I've been really successful in that. And, you know, I meet a couple people and I say, well, you know, we have a mechatronics program over here. Who's big in the community, right? And so once you make relationships, you build your network out from there intentionally and specifically, so that you can move the college forward, because you have this agenda all the time, right? And once the network is there and you've discovered the pain point and a possible solution, and you socialize that and bring the foundation in, and things happen. That's been my experience. I work with the foundation staff, we meet once a month, and we talk about, you know, future, what are we looking at? You know, what do we want to do on the campus that we need foundation funds to do? And we've been able to brainstorm and come together around some pretty creative projects over the 5 years. So I think we'd have to sit down and figure out how we make it happen, but foundation board's critical, foundation staff are critical, and bringing in the alternative sources of revenue is critical, but not, it's necessary for us to continue.
Okay.
Dr. Ryan, Jeff Bringer, Jeff Foundation. So tell us a little bit why Western, what interested you in this position, mm-hmm. in the communities that the college served?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it really, honestly, was just the, you know, they say that things happen the way that they happen, right? And there are signals, if you pay attention, you just see things happen, right? So I just finished the presidential fellowship, strange story, but I had a colleague at Wittenberg who became a president at St. Francis University in Brooklyn, and I went to the installation, and I ran into an individual who was a student of both me and the new president of St. Francis, and at Springfield, in Springfield, at Wittenberg, we probably had 1% minority, right? And this happened to be an African-American young man, and he just awesome, really bright kid, and he was there. And so I ran into him, and he had graduated from Wittenberg, went on to Harvard, okay? And I said, what are you doing? And he said, well, I'm the executive director of workforce development for the governor of Nevada. And I said, really? And he said, what are you doing? I said, well, I just finished this, you know, Aspen program, and I'm looking at a presidency at somewhere, and I'm, you know, just starting to look. And he said, look at Nevada. So that's kind of how that happened. And like I said, I started with the looking at the College of Southern Nevada, because that's, you know, he said, look there, right? And said no. Once I saw that, it was just a huge and stumbled on Western, really. But then when I went in and read the Chancellor's plan, and it just was obvious to me, right, that I'm ready to do this work. And then this is going to sound really odd, but we have rented in my local community because there's some volatility in our area, and I wasn't sure what's going to happen. So we're renting, and I got a call from my landlord who said he wants us to sign a year lease. And I said, I can't do that because I'm just starting to look for positions, right? And so I had to pack everything up, and when I'm done here, I'm moving on the 7th. So I took that as a sign, a positive sign. I was supposed to be doing this and moving forward and looking for opportunity. And while that seemed like a negative thing, I'm ready to go. I mean, my stuff's all packed up, and we have a temporary place. Both my boys will be in college in the fall, and I'll be an empty nester. And so the timing and, you know, things are lining up. But really, it was the Chancellor's plan and my skill set that I felt were the match and spoke to me, resonated with me.
Thank you. Yeah, I don't know how you follow up with the question to that, but
yeah.
Any other questions? Out in Fallon? Okay, so I'm going to move to public comment, agenda item number 8, excuse me. Is there any public comment in Carson? Okay, if you please go over to the podium.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Sign in, all that stuff. Yeah.
Now all of a sudden we get real
make
formal.
Make it official, yeah.
Okay, my name is Deborah Ellis. I work for both environmental health safety and facilities planning and management. And I was curious, fundraising, development, and alumni engagement will be major tasks for the president. Please share your experience in philanthropy with specific examples of donor activities.
Okay, so currently in my institution, the president is the one responsible for fundraising. She has allowed me to fundraise around specialized programs that are only on my campus. And so over the last 4 years, I've raised $2.2 million on my campus. In gifts and in equipment and grants. And so one specific example, I called together the 42 manufacturing companies, and then after we created the dual enrollment pipelines for them to be able to graduate with the credential, they worked together to develop a scholarship match. So one of them offered a $5,000 scholarship, and they all matched that to create scholarship opportunity for students going through those pipelines. And then they also donated equipment and resources for me to open the first precision machining lab for the mechatronics program on my campus. So those were kind of the community-based, the economic development kind of related asks. But I happen to have a very entrepreneurial faculty, and they write a lot of grants. And that requires support and work with the provost as well. And one of the great grants that we received was through ATD, which is Achieving the Dream. And we, Virginia, offered the very first degree program that required no textbooks, textbook free. It's called the Z Degree. And we use open educational resources in that to allow students to not have to pay for books, which are a significant cost. And we are now ramping that up to other options, right? So, and we put it in place for all of our dual enrollment options so that the schools don't have to buy books. So just finding creative ways to write grants and creative opportunities is pretty much what I'm about. And I, you know, there a number of them are small grants, but together, you know, they're making a difference. Yeah, right.
Can we hold for just one moment? Ralph, are they still able to hear us?
No.
Okay, we should probably hold until we can see if we can get that back up so that they can still participate. I'm sorry.
Somebody save.
This doesn't have anything to do with the meeting in particular, but you could hang meat in here. I have a sweater on.
Here. Oh, Craig is. It was too hot, and now it's too cold. Well, I did ask them to. It was too hot. Now it's very cold.
Overachievers. I do want to apologize to the review people that have to hear myself all again. And then I'm like, did I say that to them already? I just said it. It's an odd phenomenon.
Okay, I've sent the request. We could talk about the weather.
Yeah, it's chilly outside too. This morning it was beautiful yesterday, and then today it's like, oh.
Northern Nevada is bipolar.
Yeah.
Wait 10 minutes.
Well, I went and brought an umbrella.
Wait for a stoplight.
Because they said it was gonna rain.
Yeah, you never know. We could have snow by the end of the week.
You know, one thing about Nevada. So I went to the Walmart to buy this umbrella, and I go in and I say, where can I find an umbrella? And the woman says, well, just go ask Jean over there. Like, I'm supposed to know who Jean is, right? So then I go over there, and then she shows me the umbrellas, and she says, is it supposed to rain? She gets out of her head, and I'm like, so people are very friendly here.
Yes.
You know Jean.
Yeah, you know Jean.
In the umbrella section.
In the umbrella section. That's where I'm going. Where is it? So fun.
Well, hopefully you've made time to go up to Tahoe while you're here.
They say I need to do that.
Yes. It's a must.
First time in Nevada?
And my sister lives in Las Vegas. Oh.
So yes, it's your first time in Nevada. Yeah. That's the correct answer.
Yeah. If that counts, right?
Las Vegas is still Southern California.
Yeah.
Or something.
It's a different universe, for sure.
Yes. For sure.
I called my husband last night and I said, it's differently beautiful here. Because it is. I mean, I'm from coastal Virginia, so it's beautiful there too, but it's very green. And here, it's just a different kind of
It's our version.
Of we don't green. Have Fallon?
Its own version of
it. It'll take him a second.
Okay.
Give it a couple more months, it'll be greener. For about
for
a month.
Yeah.
These mountains are just
the high desert.
Just like breathtaking. If you don't live here and you see
it's
that,
right.
It's like it's very different. I'm taking all these pictures and feel like a tourist.
Oh, the drive up, just the drive up here with our backdrop. Yeah. We take it for granted. But the backdrop is gorgeous.
Back there.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
It is.
Oh, here we go.
Please. Yay.
Welcome
okay.
back, Fallon.
Tell them we've just been talking about the weather.
Yeah, honestly, all we've done is talked about the weather.
I'm waiting for you.
Okay, you're back.
So now that you're back on, is there public comment in Fallon?
I don't have a question.
No?
No.
Okay. Is there any other public comment in Carson? Don't forget to introduce yourself.
I'm Craig Robinson. I'm also in the Environmental Health and Safety Department. I am the Risk and Insurance Liaison back to the system. You mentioned in your personality program, in your personality profile, that you were a risk taker. Would you care to elaborate? Mm-hmm. Elaborate on your risk taking.
Yeah,
whether
that.
I should be concerned.
Yeah, I was going to say, not that kind of risk.
Different kind of risk.
Not safety risk. So that's funny. I've been involved in lots of your kind of work, you know, in terms of, at least from the classroom side, in terms of the OSHA regulations and making sure people are trained and know how to handle particular sciences, the chemicals, and all those things. And we had to do some specific audits. We, before my time at our college, we had an individual on a different campus in our truck driving program that actually ran somebody over.
Ooh.
And so we had really in-depth audit in terms of that. Mm-hmm. And we had to identify high-risk instructional programs as part of that. And then they have a pretty rigorous audit on a regular basis, more routine than just some typical programs. And so the provost has the responsibility to identify the high-risk programs and then make sure the audits are carried out appropriately. So I would say I'm risk avoidant in terms of safety and security issues. But in terms of being creative and improving success, I'll take risk.
Thank you.
Okay. Hearing no other public comment, we will recess and we will reconvene at 3:00.
Great, thank you very much. Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, okay, good.
Go ahead.
Yeah, now I'm like, okay, now we're really cold. He did what I asked.
Okay. I'm gonna head back.
Okay, very good.
If you need anything, if you do, text me.
Okay.